Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. My guest today is writer Cameron Hurley, award-winning writer of the God's War trilogy. Her newest books are The Worldbreaker Saga, starting with last year's The Mirror Empire and now Empire Ascendant. In 2011, Cameron won a Kitschi for Best Debut Novel and the Sidney J. Bounds Award for Best Newcomer. She's been nominated for the Clark Award, the BSFA Award and the Nebula. She's been shortlisted for the Locus Award for Best Debut and also has been on the Tiptree Award honor list. Welcome, Cameron, to Midnight in Karachi.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
And for having a very awkward intro just there, I've realized, in retrospect. All right, so seeing as we haven't talked in a while, and this is a whole other, you know, audience, because we spoke earlier on my radio show, let's talk a little bit about the general concepts and ideas and premise behind the Worldbreaker saga for people who may not know about it or may not have read the first book. Tell me what started it all way back when you first started drafting the story.
So I actually came up with the idea for this quite a long time ago, maybe in my late teens, really. And so what ended up happening was I said, hey, you know, we do a lot of fantasy novels that are, oh, the big bad. It's, oh, this the big bad other. And it is light versus dark, and we very much demonize sort of the bad guys when we talk about a lot of fantasy, especially epic fantasy. And I said, what I really want to do is I want to do something that no one's seen before, which is I want to add this parallel universes element. So let's say that two worlds collide, their universes are coming together, and one of them has to eliminate the other one in order to survive. So you end up actually literally fighting yourself. So it ends up literalizing this concept of we are going out and we're going to fight the evil, but the evil is ourselves, as opposed to, you know, making it into something other. So, and of course I want to do fun stuff on top of that as well. So there's blood mages, there's sentient plants, there's satellite magic, there's all sorts of recurring things that go on. There's really fascinating different cultures with some are polyamorous, some have third genders, some have five genders, and they have all sorts of different magic systems. So I really wanted to, you know, explore those different ideas while making a world that no one had seen before, and that ended up being what became the Worldbreaker saga.
Now, for those who haven't read The Mirror Empire, will you tell us a little bit specifically about that? And also, of course, about the newer book, the second book, Empire Ascendant. What are we looking forward to in this?
Well, a lot of Mirror Empire was kind of, you know, again, setting up this premise. We have a scullery girl who is, of course, finds out that she has this grand destiny or these great powers that people believe can actually help them with the coming collision of worlds. And then in Empire Ascendant, after we meet all of our players, we find out the stakes, we see what's going on. Each individual character gets to have their say. And then Empire Ascendant is, you know, there's kind of a spoiler in the title where
I wonder
the
what.
World, this is, I know, right? The worlds actually come together. This is really the major collision novel. This is where all the fight scenes happen. This is where people have to really make the tough decisions. There were some, you know, heartbreaking decisions in the first one, but the second one really takes that kind of to the next level. And you really get, you know, the answer to the question, which is what happens when a pacifist society has to deal with you know, the incursion of an army that comes in that is very hierarchical and has very good reasons for doing the things that they do. It's really like the Empire Strikes Back of the series. So it was quite fun to write with the very, very Cameron Hurley definition of fun.
You're going to have to tell me what that means, though. Is there pain involved?
There's pain
involved, right?
There's tough decisions. One of the things I really like to write about are people who are put in places where there is no good choice. There really is no good choice. I talk about a lot online about how I really liked Mass Effect 3, which was this video game, you know, from Electronic Arts and BioWare, and it said, there, when you get to the end, people really hated all the decisions that were given, and they are not great decisions. But the whole game was getting you toward you knowing that it's going to be very tragic, and there's going to be really tough decisions to make in the end. People didn't really like that. I love that. I think that's great. And I love giving those kinds of decisions to my characters where you do this and you're a bad guy, and you do this and you're a bad guy, and you do this and you're a bad guy. But they all have a different outcome, right? Mm-hmm. So you just kind of have to choose the least bad decision. So that was really you know, how I approach the work.
Or you're Cameron Hurley, you can pick, like, the worst decision and see where that goes.
Yeah,
that might be fun too.
They think they're choosing the worst of the, or the best.
Well, again, worst and best is relative, as we were saying earlier, right? But tell me, how was it writing the second book? Fun, as you said, in your definition, but was it easier? Was it harder? Was there more pressure or less?
For me, you know, there was a little bit of pressure in that, you know, it had a 1-year turnaround time, and so that's always very difficult. But mostly the real issue with this book was trying to make all of the timelines come together. There are some things going on in the sky. There are some astrological events, and they happen in each character's timeline at very specific times. But as I was writing it, those don't go like, and then it happens to this character in this timeline, and this one, and this, and those chapters didn't line up.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult to plot out a book where all of the things happened that needed to happen in a way that was, that on the timeline seemed consistent and made sense, and like so something was happening to one character, and then and this horrible thing happened in the sky, and then 300 pages later and this horrible thing happened in the sky, and you're like, whoa, wait a minute, like what, where are we in time? It was very confusing. And not only that, but you have characters invading from other worlds who have the same names.
Yes, same faces. Yeah.
And the same faces as a lot of, you know, characters who have, you know, died, or characters who are currently living, that now we're getting some chapters from their point of view. So trying to keep all of those timelines straight, all of the character arcs straight, and all the characters straight as we start to get not just two worlds, but then sort of multiple worlds sort of coming into this one place, was very, very difficult. That was probably my biggest challenge. I tried a lot of different things. I tried to use Scrivener. That really didn't work for me. It ended up just being me and my agent just sitting down and hammering it out. And even after that, I went back to my editor, and she's like, I just don't like the way that this is structured. Let's put these chapters over here and this over here. And so this reads this way. And I was like, oh, that's even more confusing. So we just went through like all of these iterations of where do all the chapters go, based on what is actually happening to each one in each timeline. So that was actually the toughest part. You know, I've like to think that I've gotten better at individual, you know, character arcs and you know, the overarching story, so that I knew where everybody needed to end up. It was just a matter of getting them there in a way, and placing those chapters in the right place so that they made sense when a reader approached them. I mean, copy editing this book was such a pain. It was such a pain.
I can only imagine.
People's genders change. Yeah. People.
Well, that was kind of happening the last time too.
Yeah, it was happening last time too, but in this one as well, like, some of the characters, you know, will self-identify as one gender, but then another character from another culture identifies them as a different gender because, you know, outwardly they see them and think that they're a different gender. So if I'm talking from their point of view, I have to give them the gender marker that person would give them. So I set myself up with, you know, these amazing kind of almost impossible goals, right? Like, oh, this is a really good challenge. Why don't I try this? And sometimes I fail, and that's fine. But I really want to do things that, you know, I haven't seen other people do before. And to do that sometimes is really hard. It's really difficult.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't succeed. And I mean, we'll see as the reviews and stuff start coming out. But you do the best that you can, and then you learn from each experience. Yeah. So, you know, would I have written it the same way? I don't know. Maybe I would have plotted it out a little bit better so that each character had the same amount of chapters. But then that doesn't make much sense because of, anyway. So
Let's not scare people. Let me stop you right here. I mean, I've read this. It's fine. We figure it out. Actually, you know, it's interesting because I felt this way about The Mirror Empire as well. Like I was saying to you before we started recording, that you take a lot of risks, and I think you're trying to push against a lot of sort of discover new ground. That new ground isn't always going to be perfectly smooth, but you're still going to be the first one to have pushed against it. You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, and I heard people say that about God's War as well. They said, you know, what I really loved about God's War, you know, is it the most perfectly structured book in the world? Absolutely not. But there's a lot of passion in there, and there's a lot of different ideas that I've never seen anyone else, you know, put together on the page. And it has its very own unique, you know, journey, and it's a really fun ride. And that's my hope, is that, yeah, sometimes you kind of, as a writer, this is my job. I'm supposed to look at these things and see them as imperfect. But as a reader, you can just kind of read them, and you're like, well, that was cool. You know, as a writer, you're kind of grinding against the stone for a long time. So my experience of the book is always going to be very different than readers. Because, yeah, I've, you know, my, I had a lot of fans who pre-ordered the first book, and they were able to get digital arcs of the second one for free. And, you know, they've been posting about it, and they love it and think it's a great book. And then for me, of course, I just see all the things that could have been better, and it could have been amazing. And they're like, no, it is amazing. I'm like, oh, but the in the book in your head, right, is never ends up being the book on the page. But right. to me, that's what keeps us writing, is that it's never perfect. If I wrote a perfect book, then what would be the point of writing more books? So you're always striving, you're always going out there, you're always trying to write, you know, the next great thing.
I had a question about the cast of characters a little later, but I'm going to bring it up now because you were just talking about it. You do have a large cast of characters in this entire series, obviously. I mean, yes, some of them die, but new ones come in, you know. I admit that there were times when I would get caught up in, like, the tension and the drama of the world building and the fights and, you know, all of that. And then I'd have to stop and sort of remind myself to pause and to get all the characters in order. Because it's very easy to sort of, you know, enjoy one aspect and not the rest, but to keep all things in balance. But having this large a cast, organizing them, keeping all their arcs neat and whole, as you said, it isn't easy. But what was the appeal in a large cast for you?
I wanted to write an epic fantasy. And for me, an epic fantasy meant large cast of characters. And to be honest, if we're writing a world where we have the whole premise is worlds colliding, parallel universes colliding, then you need to have multiple versions of different characters. So for me, it was, and again, also when I first came up with this series, it was meant to be like 15 books or something.
I remember you saying this, yes.
Yeah, this amazingly long Robert Jordan-esque sort of thing. And we had to condense it to 3 books. So this is actually far fewer characters than I thought I was going to do. But that's the appeal to me. To me, it feels more lived in. It feels more like a real world and less kind of like, again, this fictional sandbox that I'm actually playing in. So it was about adding texture and depth, I think.
Now, we see a lot more, well, there are plenty of complications actually in the Mirror Empire as well, but we see more complications in Empire Ascendant. We see some characters come to power, to sort of come into their powers more. Others have to pick themselves up back from where they've been sort of tossed aside, clawed at, chewed up. Others are still working things out. Lilia, who I'm very much intrigued by because, you know, hell if I can figure out whether she's the savior of all this or the inadvertent villain here, causing more trouble. But secrets, intrigues, politics, this is a big, big story that, like Mirror Empire, is pushing in all these new ideas and new ground, as I was saying earlier. What were some of your historical influences or inspirations for the series? Any real-world stuff that we're using? Has there been sort of specific research that you conducted while going about writing this?
I've talked about before, again, that I've done a lot of research, obviously, into, you know, female resistance fighters and resistance movements in general. And then I also, for this book, I had actually started doing a lot of work on genocide. Not just, of course, World War II, which all of us are very much familiar with, but also a lot of stuff that went on in Rwanda. There have been some in Cambodia. So I looked at a lot of different ways that what could compel people, and this was my central conceit, and I needed to figure this out very quickly, what compels people to, you know, murder other people? We're all human beings. If you look at, you know, kind of firing rates for armies, like around like World War One, World War Two, only about 20% of soldiers would actually like pick up a gun and fire it into a, you know, line of other soldiers. They had to actually condition people to murder people at the rates that, of course, armies would like. Murder is not something that we just one day, oh, and we just are going to mass murder people. There are a lot of different things that go into a lot of sociological things that we kind of do as a people to prepare people to do that and then to excuse that being done. So I looked into a lot of that, as I kind of went along, and into different sort of massacres and things that went on that were not great, so, and are pretty depressing. But that was where it all came from. And it all comes from a real place. I don't just, then that was really what I struggled with, was I said, you know I want to have this sort of force, that is going to come in and needs to eliminate these other people, but why would they do such a thing? And how would they make that okay? And how would they live with themselves afterwards? And that's the question of the book, because, and then the series really, is when everyone else is faced with, wow, I'm either going to be overcome by monsters and murdered by them, or I need to turn around and become a monster myself and give up everything that I believe in, what will I do when I'm backed into a corner? So you're looking at both sides. You're looking at the people who have picked up, you know, the weapons and gone after them, and then you're looking at the folks who are sort of placed in this other terrible position of, I have to fight back and I have to change myself in order to survive. Is that worth it? Is it worth going on if I have to become everything that I hate? And the answers to those questions for these people is something that I kind of figure out as they do, as we sort of write the books. I was actually saying the other day that it's so sad, you know, by the time you really understand your characters and you really know what they're all about, you're at book three and it's all over, you know. And I think that I'm sort of at that point where I'll figure it all out about the time that they do, which is, you know, the end of book three.
Killing characters off, and speaking of genocide, it's like character genocide sometimes, but do you love it? Do you hate it? Do you relish it? Because I personally relish you killing characters off. I do. I enjoy it. It's sick. It's disgusting. I know. I'm not a bad person. I swear it. But you're really imaginative, so, you know, I gotta say. Well, how do you feel about it?
It depends on the character. There's certainly one of them that gets it in Empire Senate where I was like, this is a long time coming. This is a long time coming, and this really needs to happen. And this is, you know, the person that needs to do it. So that was certainly, you know, fun. Other ones were not so fun, where I really liked the characters. I wanted them to continue on. But it was their time. So I try. And of course, you know, with this one, there's the whole parallel universes aspect. So you kind of also get to reinvent characters occasionally if the story calls for it. So there's also kind of that upside. So I don't know. Do I love it? Do I hate it? It's another story mechanic. I think that's just kind of one of the things people talk a lot about, the well scene in Infidel and how messed up that scene is. And I just go, well, you know, that was how the story went. You know, did I love writing the scene? You know, I don't know. I just like any other scene. I don't know that I relished it or whatever, but it needed to happen. And sometimes bad things need to happen to characters in order to move the story forward. And in Empire Senate, there were many people up on the docket for that book because it was the Empire Strikes Back of the series. And I knew that there were lots of things that needed to happen in book three. And for those things to happen, sort of, you know, these deaths had to occur. So it's like any other task where you're just like, well, it must be done.
I mean, we all know sometimes bad things happen to good people, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And bad things happen to bad people, too.
Yeah.
Are there any scenes that you do particularly enjoy writing?
It's a really good question. You know, to be honest, some of my favorite scenes are just scene setting. I'm a real world builder, and sometimes I really love to just... Right, and I don't write very much of them because I also like the plot to move very quickly. But I love the scene setting of here's what the towns look like, and here's, you know, what the scenery is like. And that might seem very odd, you know, to talk to somebody who writes so much character death and battle scenes, and lots of, you know, clippy dialogue is always fun too. But sometimes I really like to kind of just take that moment, and I think this is why I like it so much, is that I do, especially Empire Senate, it moves very quickly. It's like stuff is just happening and happening and happening. And sometimes it's just really nice to sort of recenter myself and recenter the narrative and say, oh, and here's this amazing, beautiful, crazy world that you have stumbled into. And it was like that with the Gosra books as well. I was stopped and scene set, you know, before I started a chapter. And I was like, wow, this world's pretty cool. It's messed up. I wouldn't want to live there, but it is certainly taking us somewhere very different. So I like to that window, right? It's like opening a window into some other world and being able to show people it and say, oh, that, remember, this is where this is going on. Isn't that amazing? This is someplace you've never really seen before. So I like that.
Is there any one thing in the new book that you think will shock people more than before?
Oh, man, that's a really good question. People react. I'm amazed at the things people react to. There's the death of a young girl that I didn't really think about at all with the first book.
Oh, you didn't think about that one, did you?
I didn't think about it.
Oh, that was... Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm not going to forget that anytime soon.
I know. And people got really upset. They got really upset about Inava and how he's treated by his wife. And they're together for like a chapter and a half. And I had this thing where I was like, oh, you know, I might have some people, you know, be like, oh, that's clear gender swap, whatever. But people have reacted very strongly in a way that also does what you know, you always hope it would do. And it actually asks them to interrogate why it is they feel that way. And if right. they would have felt the same way if those genders were reversed. And I got a lot of that when people read about Reese in the Godswear books, and they said, oh, so this is what sexism is like. Like, a lot of guys are like, oh, I had no idea. Like, this is what it's like to live in a world where you're objectified. And it was not done the heavy-handed way. And that book was I think, a little bit it was much kind of different how the society worked. But they got it, you know, after a while. And, yeah, with this one, it was really asked a lot of people to go, why does this make me so uncomfortable when I literally read this scene gender-swapped in almost every single fantasy novel I've ever read? So that was very interesting to sort of read reactions to that. But, yeah, as far as, like... Yeah, things that I think will be totally shocking. You know, I don't know. I've been looking at reviews to see if there's any like consensus as far as like the shock factors. And so far, it's just been wow. A lot of one of them was I asked for the blood to rain down, and boy did it rain down. So, like, you get what you ask for. But yeah, no, I don't know if there's any, I think some people are going to be shocked, when they, you know, read about the conflict from the point of view of the people driving the conflict. I think some people have kind of wavered on what they thought about the people on the other side when they've gotten their viewpoint, which was the point. So those are going to be interesting and gratifying to read for sure.
Now, Jonah had sent in a question asking, he wanted to know what, you know, people's definition of grimdark is, yours in particular, of course. And I wanted to know, what's the line that divides grimdark from horror? I mean, when I look at your work, you know, I think there's a lot of horror elements in it.
Mm-hmm. I find a lot of horror elements in my work as well. I think what ends up happening is, and I'm having this conversation now with some folks, we're doing a round robin interview about the new weird. And the new weird is a category that kind of bubbled up, you know, in the early 2000s right. with China Mieville, Jeff Vandermeer, K.J. Bishop. And then, you know, people jumped in the bandwagon, tried to publish some books, and they found out it wasn't new weird that was making a lot of money. It was just China Mieville. So then right. they stopped publishing it. And then we all sort of we're still all writing it. And new weird's like this amalgamation of, yeah, like these horror elements, these weird elements, these fantasy elements, some sci-fi elements. And this kind of grotesquerie, you know, things. And so that was kind of more where I feel that my work fits in, is something more kind of on that weird, new weird side. And we don't have a place to put that anymore. And I think grimdark maybe, grimdark certainly evolved more from the, oh, everyone's a bad guy. You know, is it very knee jerk away from the, you know, boy with the sword who's going to go out and become a hero and just be a hero because why not? It was much more about everything is gray and grim and, you know, the world is kind of crappy. And I have lots of those too, right? I have lots of that as well. Someone was telling me, they said, you know, the Godswear books are, you know, very grimdark because the characters aren't actually trying to even make things better. They're just trying to maintain the status quo.
Yeah.
Because the things that are going on are just going to make it even worse. And they're like, yeah, the world is not great now, but this is all, but if we don't, you know, do this now, it's going to get much worse. It's not that it's going to get better, but it's going to get much worse. And that's a very kind of grimdark, you know, view of the world, is that it's just, you know, the status quo kind of sucks, but we're still going to keep the status quo. So if I had to actually define what I write, it's certainly, I feel much more in that, you know, the genre that has gone to the wayside. Maybe I'll make my own genre. I've been talking about that a lot, where I'm like, I'll just be bug punk or grim weird. Grim weird's a good one. I think that's a very apt sort of description of what I do, because it is very dark stuff, but it's not science fiction, it's not fantasy, it's not horror. It's very much a mashup of all of those things.
So we've just coined a new term, have we? And by we,
of
I mean
course,
you.
Yeah. Yeah, all of us together. Yes, well, grim weird. No.
Mainly you, but you know. I'll take credit for where people heard it first. All right, so I like how, though, you know, this is very much a secondary world fantasy. I mean, you've made up the entire world, as it were. But you carried certain things over, and things that are now more commonplace in our world. For example, the use of pronouns other than he or she for some of your characters. Tell me about the decision to carry this across to the world that you made.
I knew I wanted to use, so this is really hard, and I get pushback from both sides, which is usually means that you're doing very well. So I knew that I was going to have one group with five genders, and I said, well, if I actually write five genders, and this is the main primary point of view, and they all are different, we have a he, a she, a they, and then two alternates, people are going to, no one's going to buy this book. It's going to be really hard to do. And so I said, well, we'll say there's five genders, but I'm not going to mark in the text. There's going to be, you know, two versions of he, two versions of she, and a they. I'm not going to mark it in the text, except occasionally someone will comment on it. Oh, they're a, you know, this kind of he or this kind of she. And then I kind of, you know, threw it out there. And then with the place that has Seidwan, which has three genders, I did want to use a third gender pronoun. And I wanted to introduce it very subtly because I knew by the time I got to book two, I was going to have at least one character point of view, probably just one, which is end up having, that's how it happened, that was just in a third gender pronoun. I went online, I looked up lots of different third gender pronouns because I really didn't want to make one up. I actually wanted to use one that perhaps some people would be familiar with, a very small portion of readers, but still at least a portion of readers, because again, it was going to reduce that, you know, cognitive dissonance that we have and like, oh, I'm not going to read that. It's like, oh yeah, I've seen that one before. Yeah, okay, I'll go with that one. And I know, in fact, know some people who use that pronoun. So that's what I wanted to do. I want to use something that was very recognizable and easy because I am trying to make, as much as people think, oh, Cameron Hurley just throws anything on the page and it's all weird and crazy, I am actually working to make this as accessible as possible without selling out. So right. I still want to make books the way I want to make them, but I want to try as much as possible to reduce the gauntlet, of course, as Justin Landon calls it, the gauntlet of like getting into this, yes, this crazy new place. So so I chose something that was certainly recognizable, you know, certainly in especially some communities and in the U.S. and use that one for my third gender pronoun. And again, I'm sprinkling it through in the last book. I sprinkled it through in the last book just a couple of times when characters in that from that particular point of view were talking about other characters, preparing the reader for, we get to book two, you have a third gender pronoun, you know, point of view, and then using it a little bit more again in book three, slowly easing everyone into it. So there's a method to the madness. There really is.
Always. Now, you're a writer who never plays down the huge amount of hard work that is needed to be a writer. You're very candid about the time it takes, the toll it takes, you know, the financial difficulties that there may be if you're only writing, the balance between writing and selling fiction and a day job. You've always been very open about all of that. Plenty of writers don't like to talk about things like money, for instance. What made you choose to be, you know, as open as you are about the, say, mechanics and the business of publishing?
Well, I think most people know that, you know, my first publisher was, you know, had some financial difficulties and had a big meltdown and the stuff didn't go out on time and it was a whole mess and they were sold to someone else who is worse, I would almost say. At least they pay me on time, so I'll take that. Sometimes when they pay me on time. We're currently involved in legal dispute or something else. But, so I had a very bad first experience with my first, series out. And what it really showed me was how much that I didn't know and that I didn't know that I was supposed to know. As a writer, we come up, especially you spend those, you know, 10 years, 15, 20 years learning your craft and learning how to write. And you have to spend all that time learning how to write because you have to at least reach a certain level of good in order to compete with everybody else. Well, once you get there, what actually keeps you there is realizing that you are a small business and that you really need to, you know, look at yourself and your work and what you do is the same way that an entrepreneur would look at their business and the product that they're selling. And that's not very sexy and it's not very fun.
Right.
And it's not like, oh, and I'm writing words and they're beautiful and I'm changing the world. I mean, you can do all that too. That's the whole point. But if you want to keep doing that and you want to do it in a way that doesn't like screw over you and your work, you're mindful and strategic about the business end of it. So I've kind of gone out
and learned all of that from scratch. You know, I had a really rough time after that first trilogy came out. You know, I switched agents. I went with my new agent. We burned down a couple. You know, there was two books that I had sent her, two proposals, and she went with Mirror Empire, and we just rewrote the whole thing from the ground up. You know, went out again, tried to publish it, and we had everyone said no except for Angry Robot. They were still a smaller publisher, but by the time I got there, I was like, okay, now I'm going to do this in a way that is smart, and I'm going to do it in the correct way. I did much more marketing for my work. I was much more a hawk on the contract negotiation part. I keep in contact with my agent. We talk like at least a few times a month on via email. When there's a deal going on, we have long conversations about, okay, is this really the right time to go out with this project? You know, it's great that someone wants to buy something from you, but should we really sell that to them? The fact that I could actually finally get to the point where I was having those conversations was really important to me, because I think there's a lot of, professionals who'll just be like, oh, good, someone wants to buy something. Here, say, here, we'll do a deal and send you a check. And instead, I want to be like, is this the right partner, right? Or am I going to run into another problem like I've had before? Or is this the right time because I have so much other work coming out that I should have something like this come out, you know? So those are conversations that as a new writer that I would never have thought to have before. Why would I do something like that? I just want to write a book and get it published. That's it. Well, there's a lot that happens after you get published that you never know about or think about. So I like to be very open so that people know coming into the business, okay, this is what I should be aware of. This is what I should watch out for, because it gives them a little bit, I would hope, a little bit of a, boost that I really didn't have.
Now, I'm going to say Run Along Womble, because that's the only name I know of on Twitter. Run Along Womble wants to know, if you were not writing all the books, what would you do in a month?
I'd read all the books. Yeah.
Good answer.
Yeah, I have such a big to-be-read pile. It's so sad now. I get asked to blurb a lot of books, which, oh, great, people finally send me free books. I was, like, so, like, mad. I was like, why aren't I getting sent free books? And now people send me free books. I'm like, when will I have time to read this? Why did I want this? I don't even know. That's my hope, is that I'm trying to get this book that's due to my editor on the 1st of November. So aside from those due today, so the next one that's due is due in 25 days. So as soon as I turn that in, my hope is to just kind of, be done with social media, be done with writing for a couple months, and just read books until January, because I really want to catch up. There's so many good books out right now. Fifth Season I just read was really amazing.
Isn't it? I love it too.
Oh, my gosh. It's so great. Planet Fall by Emma Newman is out next month. So there's a ton of amazing work coming out, but I don't have time to read any of it. So that's my hope, is that I can just spend a couple months reading.
Okay, somebody else has asked on Twitter, and I don't know how to pronounce their Twitter handle, so I'm just going to say it phonetically, which is Kenta Kohut, I think. Forgive me, I'm doing the best I can. But this person wants to know, of all the characters you've written so far, who do you relate to the most? What is that laugh, Cameron? What is that laugh?
Well, I laugh because... Every character you write is a little piece of you, right? Like every single character, and I don't care any
scary
writer,
scary woman. Yes, it's true.
Terrifying, I know. There's little pieces of you in everyone. So for me, it's like what one do I relate to the most, or is almost like, well, you know, who do I like the most? I mean, I like different aspects of all of them. Nyx is still the most fun to write. She's also the easiest to write. And some of that is I must relate to her, I guess, more than some of the others. So, you know, Lilia, I relate to a little bit too. So, one of the hardest ones for me to actually write was Ro, the character of Ro, because he is just arrogant and he's young and he thinks he knows everything. He gets better in the second book, but writing that first book where he is just young and smart and thinks he knows all about the world was kind of tough. But Nyx, you know, has that world weary, like, I have seen everything and I know that it's tough to change things, and I'm just going to soldier on and persist and do my job and survive and try to have a little bit of fun occasionally is certainly much easier to write than some of my other characters. So yeah.
Kate Elliott wanted to know how your experience in marketing informs how you make career planning choices, or, you know, how you don't, I suppose.
around is quite a lot. It is probably, again, the better I've gotten, I think, at marketing, the better I've been able to kind of manage my career, because I'm more aware of it. And some of that is just when you give a lot of advice to other companies, you start going, why aren't I taking my own advice? Like, I know these things, and I get to test a lot of strategies, you know, with different brands. And so I know, like, okay, well, that worked for them. And, you know, here's something else that works. Or I do research related to that that I can then, you know, roll out for my writing business. Right. So yeah, it certainly informs a great deal of what I do, and certainly how I kind of comport myself on, you know, on social media and Twitter. It was funny, my agent actually emailed me a few weeks ago, and she said, Cameron, you know, you're going a little dark on Twitter right now. You've been kind of down and dark. And she's just like, I just need you to know, remember that your brand is not grim, it's grim optimism. Yeah. She's like, remember to keep the optimism in the grim. And I'm like, all right, Anna. So it is something that you certainly are aware of, and you certainly take into account as you're doing all of your work, as you're kind of living this public life. I had another agent who I just know socially, and he was just like, I don't know how you writers do this thing where you kind of lay yourself out in the court of public opinion. And I think some of it is you just kind of have to go. For a lot of people, they are not rating a person. They are rating a business on Yelp. And you are a product, and you put out things, or they think that you're some kind of, you know, public celebrity who makes $1 billion a year. And so it's worth it so you deserve to be, you know, kind of laid out and eviscerated. And you just have to kind of take your hits. If people are going to treat you like a business, you really need to act like a business, or it's hard to make it if you think of yourself as that you take all this really personally, and you go, they are coming after me or your book, you know, you make your book into yourself. And like, you can't do that. If you do that, you're not going to make it. You have to really start thinking of yourself like that, like a business. And maybe that's, honestly, I think that's been a really good help, especially the more work I get out, is going, okay, they're not attacking, you know, me as a person, or they don't think of me as an actual person. I'm kind of some kind of constructed business restaurant thing in their head. And then I can go off and be like, okay, well, they're really mad at that restaurant today, and kind of move on and go write my books. So
Jonah had another question. One, he wanted to know how you decide which fantastic mind-bending elements to include and which to leave for a future book. And I have to admit, I think I've asked you some variation of this question before at some point, because, you know, I keep thinking there are like 1,000 crazy ideas in your head, but sifting through them to pick the ones that fit, you know, leaving aside certain ones, using them perhaps later, all, I mean, I suppose there are ideas that you just, you know, leave out completely.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Usually when I start like a world building process, I will go to the library and just check out a bunch of books about many different things that I'm interested in, and go through their bibliographies and check out more books and just read things and make notes. And sometimes, yeah, things just sort of come together organically where they just sort of make sense with the world. And if they don't make sense, you go, okay, well, maybe I'll keep that one for later. To some extent, you know, for me, I don't want to overwhelm readers too much. And I think, again, looking at all the things I throw in, it is hard, I guess, probably for people to believe, like, yeah, there is stuff that I don't put in, because I think, wow, they're going to get really confused. So there is a process of just going, what is the right balance? And maybe it's just an intuitive process for me at this point. What's the right balance between overwhelming people and make them think, well, no way, that's not going to happen, and saying, yeah, okay, well, that makes sense. And wow, you know, gosh, gee whiz, that's the reason, whole reason that I read these books. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess it feels there's a lot of gut checking. There's a lot of, you know, just me saying, yes, this is right for this book, or no, this is not right for this book. Again, in a world like, and some of it's just when you start to build the world, in a world like the World Breaker books, where so much is dependent on like the plants, and, you know, these big deadly plants and these sentient walking trees, I kind of want to focus on things related to that. I don't want to throw in like, and now we'll also have bug magic, and we'll also have, you know, deer magic, and we'll also have the, you know, you just, when you start layering on too many, it's too much for people to understand. I was like, let's keep a magic system and a weird world building thing, and then the crazy different cultures, and that's gonna be so much that will be totally plenty. I don't need to, you know, add in magical deer magic, so we're not gonna do that. So yeah, it's kind of just looking at what is the world that I've built? What are the main tenets so far? Do we have enough big pillars of things that we can keep the story on? That said, sometimes your best world building elements are really the little tiny things. I'm trying to think of some of the ones God's War I felt did these pretty well, where people do things, you know, turning on a light by tapping the light to wake up the flies, you know, the flies that make the light, and just these little tiny actions where you don't have to explain, oh, and this is the kind of bug it is, and this is why this works. It's just, I, you know, tap the light and to get the you know, bugs in there to make some light. So some of those are some of your best world building things are actually very quick and easy to do, and you can really layer a lot of those sorts of little things on there without people really sort of noticing them, because they are so organic to the story.
Now, you've got your next lot of books all sorted out, haven't you? What are they, and how does it feel to know what you'll be doing for the next, three decades?
Next year, yeah, Geek Feminist Revolution, my essay collection, that comes out May 31st. Then the space operas, The Stars Are Legion, comes out in October. And then, yeah, I have contracts for two more books after that. One, of course, is the third book in the Worldbreaker saga, which will be out in 2017. The other one is probably going to end up being like a near-future thriller for Saga Press, and that'll be 2018. So I would tell you it's not quite three decades, but that's not actually true, because I have sat down with a spreadsheet and said, okay, so what are all the projects that I would really like to write? And so I'll be sharing that with my agent in early next year, and I'm sure she's going to love me for that. But yeah, so for the next 4 years or so, I do have contracted work, which is fabulous. And some of, you know, how the next few years go, of course, is really all going to depend on how well the next batch of books goes. A lot of people, it's really funny, they always go, and there was some young writer at a convention recently, he was like, oh yeah, I've signed a 3-book deal and I'm set, you know, from then on, once you're in, and you just can just keep on publishing books. And it's like all of the writers who'd been, you know, published 3 or 4 books just started laughing, because it's totally not true. You have to keep coming out with better and better stuff, and you have to keep performing and keep selling, because there's absolutely no guarantees. You know, I get rejections all the time still. Not just for novels, but for short fiction as well. People are not always going to love your stuff. And unless you can prove that, yes, you'll make a bazillion dollars on this, they really have to love a project in order to take it on. Which I understand, because these are intensely, you know, when you're editing a project and, you know, ushering it through for a year, you need to choose stuff that you love.
So what are you up to next? Immediately, I mean. Not today, just, you know.
Well, I was going to say today. Today by midnight, I need to turn in my edits on Geek Feminist Revolution. So
that's one thing.
Yes.
How's the rest of the week looking? Yeah, well, how's the rest of the week looking for you?
The rest of the week, let's see. I have a talk I need to give at the Dayton Metro Library on Saturday. I have a story to... That does sound fun. I have a story due to John Joseph Adams for a possible anthology project on the 15th, so that's 10 days. And then in 25 days, I have to turn in the Stars Are Legion draft. So I don't know. And then I start a new job, a new day job, on the 19th of October. So
I feel like you're laughing so you don't cry.
I am. It's my secret.
It's that kind of laugh, isn't it?
Yes. And people are like, what is the secret to your success? And I'm like, you just gotta laugh. So my mom and I actually do that quite a bit, where, you know, you'll be telling the story and it's actually kind of morose and horrifying story, but you just start laughing because it's like, well, it is kind of funny that it's so awful. But as you know, as another writer, and I have other people tell me this all the time, 10 years ago, this is a great problem to have, right? I would have just been so angry at myself, be like, how are you whining? Get up off the floor, Hurley! Hit your deadlines! What are you talking about? Because this is what you live for. This was the dream, right? This is what you want, is for people to really want to
you know, commission your stuff and to buy it, to publish it, and for readers to want it and love it. And this is really the place, you know, where you want to get to. So yeah, is it difficult sometimes? Oh, sure, because you actually have to do work. Work sucks. Yeah. But it's a cool kind of work. So I've done work that's not cool. And so writing, you know, writing, being able to write and, you know, make some extra money doing, you know, writing stuff that I really love and I'm really passionate about is still the best job in the world, even with all the deadlines, for sure.
I feel,
and that's the optimism. That's the optimism.
That's the grim optimism. Well, you know, every time I speak to you, I feel like you're a shark. If you stop moving, you'll drown.
Yes.
You know, because I'm like, it's you. But you mean as much. You do find joy in this as well. You know, in the manic stages of things and stuff. I feel like you are so passionate about it that it does. That's what keeps you going, of course. And sometimes I worry because what if you didn't have a day job or what if you didn't have so many deadlines? Would you get bored, Cameron? Tell me the truth. I feel like you might get bored.
And you know what it is? I was talking to some other people who suffer from not major depression, but just, you know, kind of just regular depression. But they said, you know, that's really much their similar strategy as well, is that they stay really busy. And my thing was I would sleep for a long time. When I lived in Alaska and it was dark all the time and I was going to college, I slept for a long time. I spent a lot of time sleeping. So I need deadlines. And I've said this to people before. It sucks to have deadlines and it's very stressful, but at the same time, would never have gotten this amount of work done, and I would never have had, you know, all this stuff for people to read if I didn't have contracted deadlines, because I just wouldn't have the impetus to do it. It just wouldn't drive me. But knowing that other people, and in fact, like this whole machine, like the Tor machine is sitting there waiting for this book to come in on time tonight. Knowing that that has to kick up so that we can hit that May 31st deadline is very invigorating. So it's like they've done the cover and they got to get their media stuff. And so knowing that, I think, has been very good for me as a writer and good for readers, because then they get more stuff. Because, yeah, I mean, if I didn't have all of these things, people ask, oh, what would you do with your life? And the answer is, like, there's nothing else I want to do. There really isn't. I guess I could read books, but I don't know. This is what I really want to do. So yeah, it's rough and it's tough, but this is what I fought for. And so once you get here, you actually, and again, as I tell new writers, once you get here, then you have to be ready to be here, because that's when the real work starts.
So am I going to speak to you next year when the next book comes out, or is it going to be sooner than that? It will be sooner than that, won't it?
Yeah, maybe it will be sooner. I don't know. Are you going to go to Helsinki in 2017?
2017 is a long time away for a Pakistani.
I know, you're like,
I have a Pakistani passport. Let's not talk about what visas I'll get in 2 years. I don't even know what visas I'll get in 2 months. So I would love to, let's put it that way. I would love to, and I will try very hard to.
Yeah. But yeah, I have two books next year. So yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it goes, hopefully.
All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me today. I know, as we all do, that you have deadlines. So thank you for taking the time out, Cameron. I hope we will speak again soon.
Thank you so much.